But as I said, we're doing Pentateuch class. We're in the book of Numbers. I wrote a bunch of numbers, speaking of which, up on the board. These aren't numbers that I'm going to ask you to memorize or know, but we'll get to that. And I thought, rather than try to write it as I go and it be even sloppier than it is now, I'd put some of them up in advance and we could refer to it. But we're in chapter 30. And actually, we mostly went through chapter 30, but I wanted to revisit just a couple things about it. This is the chapter that it speaks of vows first, and it makes the principle, you know, we talked about what a vow was, and my short, easy definition is that it's a promise to God, and generally, we think of it as having to do with a religious promise. You know, it could be a promise to practice some type of abstinence, like fasting or something else. Could be a Nazirite vow, which isn't entirely clear in Scripture what that is, but a lot of people, including me, think it tends to relate to service in the tabernacle or temple. Basically, for someone who's not a Levite wanting to participate in that type of service. So it could be giving things to God or giving things to charity. You know, so these are vows. And it says very clearly, once you make a vow, follow through. God takes these things very seriously. So much so that Jesus came along later and said, look, there's so many things outside of your control, just don't make vows. And that's our standard teaching in the church. You know, we don't make vows. The one thing, we enter a covenant with marriage, and likewise at baptism, we're entering a covenant. One of the things we do is, for instance, if you sign a document or you go into court, they ask you to take an oath. Our standard thing is to say, I will affirm. You know, meaning I attest I'm saying the truth, but I don't say I vow or I take an oath because we want to, you know, we do that following Jesus' instructions. So anyways, he goes on from there, though, to describe these special circumstances for women. And we address that, and we could sum it up by saying, if a woman is under a man's authority, that man has a right to overrule her vow. He can make it void when he hears about it. The man whose authority she's under could be her father. And typically it says a young woman in her father's house, or it could be a husband if the woman's married. As I said, that strikes us as somewhat sexist in our society. I think a partial explanation, or perhaps the main explanation, is the fact that in that culture and society, women in those states weren't considered to be the owners of property. And a vow usually would be a commitment of some type of property. So the idea was, okay, the man who has responsibility for that property should have some say about whether or not a vow affects it. And it does make the point towards the end, actually specifically verses 9 through 12, that a woman who is divorced or widowed did have the right to enter a vow. A man doesn't overrule that. So it's not saying women never have any right or authority. It's just a matter of if she's making a commitment that's going to affect a man, the man who has authority over her and or the property she lives off of, he gets the final say. Another reason I wanted to bring this up is also, well, a couple things. Well, before I move on, it's important verses 13 through 16 here make the point that if the husband or father, when he learns of this vow, if he keeps his mouth shut, that's the same as affirming the vow. So he has to take overt, specific action to negate a woman's vow. So him doing nothing or saying nothing lets the vow stand. And once that passes, you know, apparently it's too late. So, you know, he's got to speak up when he learns of it or else he loses his opportunity. Yeah, Nate?
When you say affirming, you're just saying you're acknowledging it, but you're not holding to it?
Yeah, you mean the husband or father? Yeah, basically, if he doesn't overturn it, then he's letting it stand. So, in essence, he's silently giving his support to it or acknowledging it. Okay. One question I've seen come up, because in, matter of fact, let's see where it says. In verse 3, it says, if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth, you know, how we like to pick things fine. Some people said, well, what if she's still in her father's house and she's not in her youth? And how do we define youth? Because it doesn't mean when she's like 8 years old. What if she's 16? What if she's 20? You know, what if she's unmarried and living at home till she's 25, 26? I could speak my wife I think she was 28 before she finally got her own apartment and moved out from her parents' house. It doesn't give us an answer, so I'm not going to pretend that I have one. But one of the reasons that comes up is some people have cited this particular section of Scripture and said, I'm my daughter's father. Well, obviously, you know. So some fathers have said, hey, she can't take a vow unless I give the okay. Marriage is entered by a vow. Some have taken it to mean the dad has the right to decide whether this woman, whether his daughter can marry someone or not. And I would say not everyone holds to that interpretation. And I've seen it discussed back and forth. I haven't seen it very seriously come up in the church, but it has come up. And some fathers saying, hey, how much right do I have in this? If I don't like that guy, can I stop her from marrying him? And my thought has been, well, you might claim Scripture, but if they go to a justice of the peace or somewhere, they get married, they're married, whether you like it or not. It's not something that comes up often, but one of the things I would say is I encourage daughters and fathers and husbands-to-be to all get along and agree on these things in advance. Matter of fact, I remember when I was a teenager, this is sort of getting off the track, but I remember a friend of my sister's, so he's an older guy, telling me, look, when you like a girl, get in good with her mom. That even if dad doesn't like you, mom will get you by. But I would say my experience has been it's good to be good with dad. Of course, it's best to be in good with a girlfriend, first of all. But I'm veering wide from where I meant to go. I don't have any questions on that. I just, as I said, we want to look at the Scripture and see guidelines for our lives, even though we would consider this to be part of the civil law of the land and not necessarily a binding on us as Christians today, especially the fact that when we would look where Christ said, don't take a vow at all. We would see that as the higher authority in this case. Okay, so with that, I want to move on to chapter 31. As I'll remind you, we're getting in the wrapping up stage of Israel's wandering and preparing to enter the promised land. Not enter the wilderness, they're finally done with the wilderness. But God has some business for Moses to take care of. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, take vengeance on the Midianites for the children of Israel. Afterwards, you'll be gathered to your people. So, and by the way, gathered to your people, that's a nice euphemism. It means you're going to die. But whenever that phrase is used, it implies a peaceful death. Like not being killed in battle or in some, you know, violent crime, but a peaceful ending of your days. Gathered to your people. So Moses spoke to the people, arm some of yourselves for war, go against the Midianites, take vengeance for the Lord on Midian. I find it interesting to say that God says, take vengeance on Israel. Now Moses is telling Israel, take vengeance for God. I mean, I don't think it's a contradiction, but I think rather it's showing that their cause is one and the same. God's cause is Israel's cause here, and Israel's cause is God's cause. You know, the crime that the Midianites committed was a crime against both. Now, who were the Midianites? We see their name come up. We believe they were primarily a nomadic peoples, thought to be descended from Abraham and his second wife, Keturah. And there's some room wondering how much mixing had there been since the man Midian was born to Keturah to this time. And one thing we'll want to note that later it shows like it seems to indicate the Israelites wiped them out. But Midianites appear in the story of the Bible for hundreds of years afterwards. So the indication is Israel went to war against the Midianites that were in that area, but as they were nomadic peoples, it wasn't a genocide. They weren't all wiped out. So let's not think that, you know, the description we see here will include, you know, is implying that all of them were wiped out. Now, what's the crime that they committed? Do we remember? Well, it's referring back to, I'm looking for where we have it, in chapter 24. It's after Balaam failed to curse Israel, but as we see from this coming chapter, he advised the Moabites and Midianites to send their women to seduce the Israelite men and lead them into idol worship. So this is that's the crime that's going to be punished. It could raise the question, well, why are they focusing on the Midianites more than the Moabites? And it seems perhaps the Midianites were more prominent in that particular episode. Although it doesn't specifically state that here. Anyways, the next few verses, starting in verse 4, you see 1,000 from each tribe. So they're going to have 12,000 warriors go out. From each tribe will exempt a Levi. So they're counting Ephraim and Manasseh. Levites aren't involved in the battle. So they go out, and significantly, verse 6 shows us Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, goes. So Eleazar is now the high priest, and his son Phinehas is what is sometimes called the second priest. So the high priest is not going to be allowed to leave and go become unclean by being around dead bodies and such, so his oldest son can go. There's a question. It says the holy articles and the signal trumpets. Earlier, we remember Moses was commanded to have the workmen create 2 silver trumpets that would be sounded for special occasions. We know the trumpets are going. What are the holy articles? Is it another way of referring to the trumpets? Most scholars believe, though, that it's saying that the Ark of the Covenant would go. I would make the point, if so, it would have the veil covering it. The Ark never traveled just out in open sight, regardless of all the artists' depictions that we've seen. And I still have room to question, because it doesn't say the Ark of the Covenant. I'm not sure what other things it would be, but I just have trouble thinking that God is real casual about sending the Ark out. But I'm probably in a minority. So, you know, most scholars would say, well, it seems to mean the Ark of the Covenant goes out in battle before them, which would symbolize that God is going before them. Remember, it's pure symbol. The Ark is not magic. It doesn't have special powers. It's symbolic of God's presence. Okay, and of course they do. They go out and do this. In verse 7, they warred against the Midianites just as the Lord commanded. Okay, give them credit. You know, again, they do what God says in this case. They killed all the males. We'll see a couple of exceptions here, but they killed the kings of Midian with the rest that were killed. And we see several names, one of which is Zur, Z-U-R. Worth mentioning, he's the father of Cosby, that Midianite woman that went in with a prominent Israelite that Phinehas ran through with the javelin. So this is one of the cases that tells us she was from a very prominent family. Her father was among those referred to as a king or a leading person. So, you know, that incident has more weight than we might have thought. It's not just two, you know, I was thinking of the term we sometimes use. Well, in some areas, at least in the U.S., there's a term called trailer trash of people of lower economic means. And I don't want to be disparaging because I've lived in a mobile home at least twice in my life, so I could have had that term applied to me. And who knows, might again. But I'm saying it's the upper echelon of society are represented here. And significantly, at the end of verse 8, Balaam, the son of Beor, they killed with the sword. Now, Balaam's there. Remember in chapter 24, verse 25, it said that Balaam went home. I mentioned at that point, either he went back to his home and then returned because he got this great idea, or he was on his way home and he stopped because he got this idea of, hey, I can't curse Israel, and I'm putting words in his mouth, but if I can't, if we get them to sin, they'll bring God's curse on themselves. And we see that described actually later in this chapter in verse 16. Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord. So it's very clear, you know, Moses knows how that happened. It's also mentioned in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14 that Balaam gave this counsel of how to make Israel sin. In Revelation 2 and verse 14, it's being cited as sort of an allegory of being spiritually seduced to false theology or false philosophy. So being seduced into sexual sin is bad enough on its own, but it also can represent being seduced into idolatry and spiritual sin. And for the ancient Israelites, those two went together. You know, they were seduced by these women, and then they went and worshipped idols as well, and God was angry and he had them killed. We want to avoid that type of punishment. Anyways, moving on, we've discussed this before, but I wanted to make note of it as we go along. Verse 9, though, shows they didn't kill everybody. The children of Israel took the women of Midian captive with their little ones and took as spoil all their cattle, their flocks. But they burned with fire the cities where they dwelt in their forts and took the spoil and the booty, man and beast. burning the cities, well, taking the livestock would be normal. And unless God specifically forbids it, it's a natural thing. And so we see it happen here. It happens again in the book of Joshua. Burning the cities might have been unusual, but perhaps it's a start of erasing the pagan culture that they're going to replace with a new culture. Because many of these cities will end up being rebuilt, but they'll build up from the ground. Now, God is going to take some exception to this. Well, Moses will, I believe, with God's guidance. Verse 12, of course, they brought the captives and the booty and the spoil to Moses, to Eleazar the priest. Moses, they go meet them outside the camp. Verse 14, Moses was angry with the officers. You know, he comes and says, have you kept all the women alive? And he said, what are you keeping the women alive? Well, normally you don't kill women and children. Even soldiers don't do that. And that is the normal course of events. We'll see, and you've already seen, you've gone through the book of Joshua, that when the Israelites went in, God specifically said, eliminate them all. You know, men, women, young, old, with the idea that we're going to erase all of that pagan culture, false religion, everything that could affect you, knowing that God will bring them up in the resurrection. Again, only God could give a command to kill all the people. It's in His authority, you know, not ours, not the ancient Israelites. But we want to remember that God is a loving, merciful God. Some people will point to this in the Old Testament and say, oh, I can't worship a God like that. But they don't understand the idea that death is like a moment of sleep, that you know, you don't have any consciousness. All those people's next waking moment will be coming up in, you know, a much better world. You know, after the millennium, where the world will have been rebuilt, we'll be ready to teach all those people the truth. So let's not dwell on what seems cruelty and harshness. We want to keep in mind God's greater plan. And I don't mean to present it as though you don't know these things, but it's just a reminder. But they saved the women and the children because that was their natural proclivity. And I think that is a good thing. You know, I think that's a trait that has persisted in the descendants of Israel to this day, of naturally being kind and lenient and sparing people rather than being naturally cruel. I should hesitate because I could find you many examples in American history of cruelty and harshness to other peoples, but I don't want to dwell on that for right now. Anyways, moving on, Moses is angry. He reminds them, as we just read, that the Council of Balaam, they used these women to lead people into sin. So in verse 17, here's the decision, and we got to say, this is coming from God. Kill every male among the little ones. So the men are not going to be allowed to continue. All of this race is going to be exterminated, you know, waiting for the resurrection. And then kill every woman who has known a man intimately. And he makes it clear what he means later. You can keep alive for yourselves all the young girls who have not known a man intimately. And he goes on from there. So only women. Oh, actually, if you want to make a reference to similar commands later, we have a couple in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 through 4, is instruction to do this when they cross the river and enter the promised land. So that was Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 4, and it's repeated again in Deuteronomy chapter 20, Deuteronomy 20, verses 16 through 18. So only women that, you know, were virgins were permitted to live. The idea is obviously they had not participated in the seduction of the men of Israel because that involved sexual sin. So that's the main, I guess one of the main criteria. So this is going to eliminate any who have been involved in fornication. I don't know that God was thinking this, but I've seen some sources have pointed out that this would also be a strong measure to eliminate bringing sexually transmitted diseases into Israel from another nation. So that's perhaps a side benefit. So they're going to do that, and then the men are going to have to remain outside the camp for the normal purification. Verses 19 and 20, they have a week where they got to stay outside because they've been defiled by dead bodies. Yes, Dr. Britt?
I was going to add that also a big part of the pagan worship involved sexual acts, and so this would indicate that they had not participated in that, so perhaps their ties to the pagan religion were not as strong as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, if they're virgins, they would not have participated in any ritual sex acts, you know, in the groves or at a pagan temple. And that was common in a lot of the pagan worship. So being purified, of course, they have to stay out in this quarantine, have the water of purification sprinkled on them on the third day and I believe the seventh day. So we'll see that, yeah, it's mentioned there. We'll come back to that. Purify every garment, everything made of leather, woven of goat's hair, everything of wood. So things that, well, it'll go on to say if something can endure fire. So if it can go through fire and not be destroyed, put it through fire. All the gold, metal, whatever. That'll, for one thing, it will achieve disinfection. We don't think that these people understood microbes back then, but God surely did. But if something couldn't be put through fire that way, it would be thoroughly washed. And it seems all, both the people and all the booty, would have the water of purification sprinkled on them. What's the water of purification? It seems to be the same water that was referenced in Numbers chapter 19, where they had to burn the red heifer down to ashes, adding cedar and scarlet and hyssop, and then those ashes could be sprinkled in water to make the water of purification. It's a symbolic action. There's nothing that we know of scientifically that would make that water have antiseptic qualities or things like that, but it is, of course, the heifer is burned, and I mentioned there's a reference in Hebrews of it being burned outside the camp. The connection made, well, Christ was crucified outside the camp. Let's go to him. I wonder, with this much, did they have to burn down a few red heifers to get enough ashes for, 12,000 men and all these people and animals? And that's just me wondering out loud. I don't know. But we see an interesting principle come up once this is done. After they go through the purification, after the seventh day, they can come back into the camp. Verse 25, he says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Count up the plunder that was taken, of man and beast. You and Eleazar the priest and the chief fathers of the congregation, and divide the plunder into two parts,'" okay, "'between those who took part in the war,'" that's these 12,000 soldiers, "'and the everybody else who didn't.'" This is a principle of dividing captured goods evenly. Dividing evenly between those who go do the actual fighting and those who stay behind. It's worth connecting this to 1 Samuel 30, verses 20. My notes say verses 25 through 25. I think I might have a typo there, but it's somewhere either ending in verse 25 of 1 Samuel 30 or starting there. But you might remember the story. That's the last episode that David had before he actually gets to become king in Judah, when the Philistines wouldn't allow him to go out to battle, so they sent him back to Ziklag. But he comes back to Ziklag and finds out some Amalekites had come and raided the city. They burned his village and took off all the women and children and the cattle. So he and some men go after them. And some of the men are too exhausted to go over the brook Bezor, so they stay behind and watch the stuff while David and the rest go, and they defeat the enemy, bring back everybody alive. And the guys that went over said, "Oh, those guys that stayed behind, we're not going to give them any of the plunder. Let's let them take their wives and children and make them get out of here." And David says, "No, I'm making it a law. We divide evenly between those who go to battle and those who stay behind." We can see here David wasn't the first to come up with that idea. He was instituting something that God had told ancient Israel to do, divide evenly. Now, we can make a strong case, though, evenly, okay, and I put the numbers up here, like there's 675,000 sheep. Okay, so 337,500 are going to go to the soldiers, 337,500 are going to go to the people. Does that mean everybody living in Israel gets the same amount of? Of course not. There's about 12,000 soldiers and a couple million people. So the soldiers are going to get a higher percentage. You could say that's just because they went and put their lives on the line and did the fighting. But they only get half of the goods, however much the goods are. So they divide that amongst themselves, and then the people divide half among themselves. And we'll see, God says, "I'm going to take a levy. You're going to give a certain amount to me." And he'll levy it from some from the soldiers. Now I didn't write down the ratio. Is it 1 in 10? Let's see. It starts in verse 1 in 500. Thank you. Yeah, it's there in verse 28. A tribute on the men who went out to war, one of every 500 of the persons, cattle, donkeys, and sheep. Okay, now the levy on the people is 1 in 50, I believe, which is, I'm looking for the exact scripture. If someone sees that, you can check. I'm sorry? Verse 30, thank you. Oh, it's that close. Okay, I was looking further ahead. So the idea is God is going to take a smaller percentage from the soldiers, once again acknowledging that they went out and did the actual hard work and risk, you know, and so they're going to give up less of their plunder. The people are going to give up more. So the plunder from the levy for God from the soldiers goes directly to God. Now, I don't suppose God drove up in a pickup truck and took all the animals back to heaven with him. It's generally thought that, okay, that went to the priesthood, to Eleazar and his family, whereas the levy from the people went to the Levites, which is a much broader number. And the Levites didn't send any soldiers, so the Levites would get nothing if it weren't for this. So they get a certain amount. And I broke down the numbers, you know, 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys. And again, the only reason I have any memory of how many this is because I tallied it up and put it in my notes. So I'm not asking you to memorize this or even necessarily to write it down, but I wanted to show the consistency that God set this principle in motion and they did it very specifically. He doesn't describe what they would do with the inanimate goods. You know, if you've got a certain amount of gold or garments or things like that, it's not really specified. So it might have gone through a similar process, or maybe the soldiers just got to keep that stuff. We'll see reference to some of it afterwards. Now, the big question, and I only wrote it in a different color ink because the blue pen was going dry, but I've got people here. Okay, these are the young women who were virgins who weren't put to death. So they're, well, what's their status? Say they're going to be servants. You could say in some cases they might be slaves, but I would think a large number will end up being what we call concubines. They're likely going to be married into the people of Israel, and their lineage might become mixed so much that within a few generations, you know, unless someone's keeping track, they wouldn't know they had a Midianite ancestor. If we're correct that the Midianites are descended from Abraham, again, there's a fair bit of shared ethnology anyways. And supposedly, they're going to be forced to accept the true God and the true religion. So they're going to integrate with the people. I would say that those that are given to God are going to become servants there at the tabernacle and perhaps household servants to the priesthood, and similarly for the Levites. So I look at this, I lay it all out and say, okay, somewhat interesting to me, not the most intriguing or important part of the Bible that we need to memorize, but again, we see, I think, a consistency in God dealing with peoples and what he's doing. I find at the end of the chapter, starting in verse 48, something, I want to give the Israelites credit for realizing who gave them this victory. In verse 48, the officers who were over the thousands of the army and the captains, they came near to Moses and said, look, we've taken account. So we did a roll call, and not a man is missing. You might say, well, of course not a man is missing. God gave them the victory. But if you study any kind of military history, to have a skirmish even, or an even small, fairly insignificant battle with zero casualties, that's pretty unusual. So to go and have this pretty major impact with thousands of people killed and taken captive and all that, and the Israelites do not lose one single man, that's nothing short of miraculous. And it's very clear it was a miracle. And they were surprised. In the heat of battle and the fog of war, you're doing this or that, they come back, they expect to, okay, let's take roll. We're going to have to go offer condolences to the wives or the, you know, the families of the men who were lost. It always happens that way, but not this time. You know, God perhaps had angels out there with them, and not a single man fell. And so they noted that, and they said, we want to give a special offering to God. So we brought an offering. It says, every man found ornaments of gold, armlets, bracelets. So they took, you know, art jewelry and stuff, and gold and perhaps silver from the enemy, and they gave a gift to God to show what a miracle this was. Verse 52, well, it says, Moses and Eleazar received the gold. You could say, on behalf of God, they accept this gift, and it's going to go into the treasury of the tabernacle. I don't know, it's not like they could put it in a bank safety deposit box, but it says it's laid up there in the tabernacle. And as a matter of fact, it mentions in verse 52, 16,750 shekels. And in this case, I haven't tried to do the math or found a reference that says how much weight that would be in modern terms, but it's a significant amount. And verse 54 says, they brought it to the tabernacle of meeting as a memorial for the children of Israel before the Lord. Again, a significant thing, and let's give the men credit for saying, hey, this isn't because we're such great soldiers. This was a miracle of God. Let's make a special gift to show that we appreciate that miracle. Because we often say in our modern society, we say you can't put a price on a person's life. And in this case, they're not saying this is the price, but they want to give a token of appreciation. Okay, so that's behind us. We move into chapter 32, and another, I'd say a famous incident, but one that's going to have repercussions down through history. It says, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of livestock. So for some reason, they seem to have more animals than a lot of the other tribes. And they saw the land of Jazer, the land of Gilead, and indeed the region was a place for livestock. They're talking about the area that they'd conquered when they destroyed the Amorites. So it's this area, the Transjordan area. They say it's good for livestock. That makes me think of what kind of land? Grassy plains. Yeah, I think of, grassy plains, a place where, okay, there's a lot of good grass, and, it might be good for crops too, but it's like, man, this is ideal. And it's thought that I think it gets a little less rainfall, so, and it's more flat, good for livestock. Not surprising that these two tribes come to this together. If you remember that chart where we saw the tabernacle in the middle and God assigned the tribes where they would camp, Reuben and Gad were on the same. They were both camped south of the tabernacle. So they were next door to each other. Their leaders must have spent time together saying, hey, look at this opportunity. This is going to be great pasture land, so let's go ask for it. At least that's what seems to happen. They came and spoke to Moses and Eleazar. That's verse 2. I list the places, but in verse 4, the country which the Lord defeated before the congregation of Israel is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. Say, look at this, good land for livestock. We've got livestock. You see the wheels turning. To me, to see this is kind of amusing how they put it together. Therefore, verse 5, if we found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Don't take us over the Jordan. Why should we go over there and take other land from people when this is perfect for us? They might have expected Moses to go, wow, what a great idea. You guys are so smart. But Moses instead has maybe a surprising reaction. Moses, starting in verse 6, says, shall your brethren go to war while you sit here? You guys want to sit around and watch TV all day while they're going off to war? Why will you discourage the heart of the children of Israel from going to the land which the Lord has given us? Didn't your fathers, thus did your fathers when I sent them away from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. And he makes reference to the 12 scouts going into the promised land. So you see in Moses' mind, he flashes back 38 years to the children of Israel saying, oh, we can't go, we can't dispossess them. His natural suspicion says, these guys are cowards, they don't want to go fight anymore. And that's going to discourage everyone else. So he jumps to that conclusion, and he says, that happened, and we ended up wandering for 40 years. Do you want to make us go wander another 40 years? He sort of implies that's what could happen. In verse 10, the Lord's anger was aroused on that day. He swore an oath, saying, none of them who came up from Egypt from 20 years old and above will see the land, except for Caleb and Joshua. Verse 13, the Lord's anger was aroused against Israel. He made them wander for 40 years till that generation had done evil and the sight of the Lord was gone. And look, you've risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase still more, the fierce anger. If you turn away from following him, he'll once again leave them in the wilderness. So he makes it very clear, you can't do that same thing again that the generation before us did. We're going to end up wandering in the wilderness again. This strikes me as a time where I think Moses jumped to the wrong conclusion, because all the evidence shows that that's not what they were thinking. They weren't trying to get out of going and fighting. They weren't, you know, trying not to go in the promised land. They were just saying, hey, we've conquered this land. It's good land for cattle. Look, we got a lot of cattle. You know, we'll be happy. And so give them credit. They don't yell back at Moses. They patiently explain what they have in mind. Verse 16, they came near to him. Maybe, hold on a minute, listen, give us a chance. We'll build sheepfolds for our livestock, cities for our little ones, so we'll set them up, but we ourselves will be armed, ready to go before the children of Israel till we've brought them in our place. You know, of course, our little ones will dwell in the fortified cities, so we got to make them safe. But verse 18 says, we will not return to our homes till every one of the children of Israel has received his inheritance. Okay, so we're not trying to get out of anything. We're going to be out there in front fighting with them. But we won't inherit the land, so we're willing to go fight so they get theirs. But we understand if this works out, we won't be getting that land. We'll have had ours designated for us over here on the eastern side of the Jordan. And Moses said, well, if you do this thing, you know, if you arm yourselves before the Lord for the war and all your armed men cross over to Jordan and the land is subdued, this is in verse 22, this land will be your possession. Verse 23, but if you do not, take note, you've sinned, and be sure your sin will find you out. I like to point that out. I think that's one of the great quotes of the Bible. Be sure your sin will find you out. I don't remember my mom ever quoting that to me, but it bore out in my life. Matter of fact, I often tell people one of the reasons I turned out as good as I did is I never got away with anything. If I did something, it was found out. My sister got away with all kinds of stuff. I did one thing, I got caught. And I'm so glad that that happened that way, because I think it stopped me from doing, I was going to say greater things, I should say worse, bigger things. Not greater in the sense of being good at all. Yes, Kayla?
It made me think of the idea, so if they're keeping this land on the east side of the Jordan, was that the original part of the promised land, if it's their idea?
I think it was, actually. So they came up with this idea, but God had already conquered them. And we're going to see when we come to the book of Deuteronomy that Moses will fill in some gaps that he hasn't described yet, where God will tell him, I'm not giving you any of the land of Moab. Don't fight them. And he'll say, I'm not giving you the land of Ammon. Don't fight them. But when the Amorites show up, he says, go get them. I'm giving you their land, go destroy them. And so they do. They take the land of Gilead and Bashan. And actually, coming up in, I think, the next chapter, God's going to tell them the borders of the promised land, and it will include that, the area they have. And there's the idea that he intended them to have much more. You know, he promised Abraham, we see the ultimate boundary being from the river, meaning Euphrates, all the way to Egypt. So God intended it to be this big, you know, rather than just the smaller area that they got. So that's a good question, Kayla, but I don't think God said, I'll change my plan and I'll give you a little more land. But he let them go through the process on their own, which I think he does that for us many times. There might be something he has in mind or he's working out, but he'll let us take the long, winding road that it takes us to get there. So, and by the way, we can make reference, Joshua 4 and verse 13 will show that they did indeed send men. They sent 40,000 men over the Jordan to fight. Now, that was probably mostly younger single men, because 40,000 is a large number, but if you look at the number of their tribe, they left plenty of men behind to guard the women and children. And as I said, probably older men or married with a lot of kids. So they didn't say every single male who can walk and talk among you's got to go fight. But 40,000 for just 2.5 tribes, it turns out, would be pretty significant. So they lived up to their end of the bargain. And of course, as we know, that when it was all said and done, finally, after they divided the land, they headed home. And there's a famous story where they stopped at the Jordan and built this large altar that was meant to be a monument, but the Israelites said, they're worshiping false gods already. You know, we got to charge down there and stop them. And they made the point, no, no, this isn't a sacrifice on, this altar is a memorial to, so in future generations, your children won't tell our children, see, you're cut off and you're not part of us. We want to have a memorial that says we are part of you. So we can see early on, the men seem to be very sincere. They do want to participate. They want all of Israel to get their inheritance, but they're saying, look, somebody's got to live on this land. Might as well be us and all of our cattle. Okay, so Moses accepts the offer, as I said, a really good quote. And verse 24 says, go ahead, build folds for cities for your little ones, fold for your sheep. The children of Gad and Reuben said, okay, we're going to do what you said. You know, and so they follow through. Verse 28, Moses gave command concerning them to Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun. Moses knows I'm not going to be the one to see this bargain carried out, but I'm going to make sure Joshua and Eleazar understand it completely. So he brings them in, make sure they're aware of it. And he said, verse 29, if the children of Gad and the children of Reuben cross over the Jordan with you, every man armed for battle, we'll qualify every man for all the men who cross over, some will stay behind, and the land is subdued before you, then you'll give them the land of Gilead as a possession. If they don't cross over armed with you, they'll have possession with you among the land of Canaan. We can say, if they don't fulfill their bargain, they're not banished or kicked out of the country. The penalty for not fulfilling their part of the bargain is you got to come over here and live in a land flowing with milk and honey. It's not exactly a terrible punishment. But, you know, them thinking this is ideal, they're saying, no, no, we don't want to have to go over there and live in those silly hills and valleys. Let us stay here in the plains. And, of course, I'm inventing dialogue there for what they thought. But I like the idea that God is not saying, okay, you're going to be exterminated or banished. It's just if you don't follow through your bargain, you do have to cross over and live over here with us. And all comes through. And they say, yeah, we'll do it. Verse 33, so Moses gave to the children of Gad, to the children of Reuben. Oh, and here for the first time there's a mention of half the tribe of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. It specifies the territory of Bashan. He gave them the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, kingdom of Og of Bashan. It seems that perhaps the half-tribe of Manasseh hadn't been involved in the original negotiations. We're not sure how this happened. Maybe they looked at the map and said, you know, that's an awful big territory for just two tribes. They don't need all that. Or they might have said, you know, we got a lot of cattle too. Hey, can we get in on this deal? We don't know exactly, but half of Manasseh now comes in and they're included in this. So they jump up and say, me too. And so it goes. And starting in verse 34 all the way to the end of the chapter largely lists several of the towns that are going to have to be rebuilt. And verse 38 mentions they'll be given new names. So they've destroyed a lot of towns. They're going to be rebuilt. And perhaps some of them are given new names and not all, but it could be all of them. So, and there are a bunch of names that are hard to pronounce and we won't necessarily remember, so I'm not going to list through them. But what did I want to? Oh, now I know something else I wanted to specify. So these are the first 2.5 tribes to get their land. You know, now they've got to help conquer all the rest, but their land is here. It's awarded. Later when they draw lots, you know, these guys aren't part of that drawing. So they're the first to get their land. I find it interesting or ironic that when the Assyrians begin to invade and by waves they'll take people away, these tribes will be the first to be taken away. So they're the first in and they'll be the first out. There's a reference to that in 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 26. Matter of fact, I didn't turn there and read it before class. I want to go look and see exactly how it's worded. 1 Chronicles 5, 26. Yeah, the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, the king of Assyria, that is Tiglath-Pileser, and he carried away the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh and took them to Halah. So, yeah, these 2.5 tribes got their land first. They're the first taken away into captivity. And that gave me a chance to say Tiglath-Pileser, which is always fun to say. Okay. Yeah, actually, I didn't figure I'd get to the end of this book, although we're going to be close, because I want to just summarize chapter 33. Chapter 33 is an account basically summarizing the wandering, and a lot of it's a list of places where they camped. So it starts off seeming a little bit interesting. These are the journeys of the children of Israel who went out of the land of Egypt by their armies under the hand of Moses and Aaron. And Moses wrote down the starting points of their journeys. And as we've seen before, at the command of the Lord. So remember when God, the pillar of fire and cloud moved, they had to follow. When it stopped, they stopped. So he wrote down their starting points. They departed from Ramses in the first month of the 15th day of the first month. And the day after Passover, the children went out with boldness. So a couple of things we'll mention. Ramses, many scholars think that was the city anciently known as Hierapolis, a center of sun worship. It's not necessarily named for the pharaoh Ramses. So Ramses was a name that was more common in Egypt, so it didn't have to be that same Ramses. Where it says here they went out with boldness, I like the idea. The old King James says they went out with a high hand. You know, they went out with, I would say, exuberance and power. They were celebrating when they went out. And it's very clear the day after Passover. I was having a discussion recently with someone about the timing of the ancient Passover and the Exodus. Remember, when they went in, they sacrificed the lamb. God commanded them to stay in your house all night. You can't come out before daylight. Okay, so it's the day after. Now, it's worth noting Deuteronomy 16, verse 1 says they went out by night. And we put these together, say, okay, sacrifice the Passover, stay in your house, have the meal, stay there all night because Egyptians are dying. Get up the next day. In some cases, go plunder your neighbors. Hey, give me gold, give me silver. Get yourself organized, pack your stuff, head out, meet at a staging place. And by the time they're all marching, night is falling and it's beginning what we call the night to be much observed. So they're going out with a high hand, with boldness, you know, basically 24 hours after the Passover. And my point is, our timing that we keep it is correct. Yes, Dr. Britt?
What was the reference in Deuteronomy?
Deuteronomy 16, verse 1. I wanted to make I actually looked it up shortly before class so I could tie these together. Because there's continually question in the church about the timing. One of the things I often say, even if you're not convinced of the timing in the Old Testament, we do see in 1 Corinthians when Paul says, you know, on the night he was betrayed, Christ gave bread, you know, and that he broke the bread and he gave the wine as the new symbols. And he says, as he taught me, I teach you. So we keep the Passover when Christ kept the Passover, as he commanded us. I believe it's also in time, you know, the correct time as when the ancient Israelites did. But even if people think there was a shift, we're doing it when Christ commanded. Again, I personally think that there wasn't a shift. Let me finish one thought in verse 4. It says, the Egyptians were burying their firstborn whom the Lord had killed. Also on their gods the Lord had executed judgment. It's a reminder that God not only broke Egypt's power, but he directly discredited their false gods. And that was done largely through the types of plagues. Like they worshipped the Nile, he turned it to blood. They worshipped cattle in some cases, and he had them die of blight. So, you know, he showed he was more powerful than any false god they worshipped. So we'll pick up with there actually tomorrow.